Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening on this Monday. And there, somebody finally said it. The question rumbling around in everyone's gut around the world, from the leaders of the recently NATO member Baltic states, certainly the fragile government in Ukraine, has asked the question quietly. What of the people of Taiwan, though? Poland? South Korea? What nation will the U.S. go to war for to keep from disappearing? It is the question right there on the cover of the May 5th Economist magazine. What would America fight for? Well, while you contemplate that, we'll also have a close-up look at the unrest in Odessa, Ukraine this hour. We'll look at a plan for international cooperation bypassing nations and the United Nations, software engineers to the rescue. And we'll have a haunting story of a man whose nation vanished in basically a single night. An East German thinks about what happens when history literally wipes you and your country off the map. But first, we turn once again to former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderberg, with a question of U.S. commitments around the world. Ambassador, welcome.
My pleasure.
So how do we evaluate the question of what commitments that the U.S. has on paper are absolutely inviolate, and which ones are a little shakier? In a sense, all of them are subject to the change of historical events, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the United States has obligations that it very strongly stands by, particularly take NATO. We've made it very clear that in Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all, something that's only been invoked after 9/11, which is why European troops are still in Afghanistan, even though it's very difficult. So we can change agreements, but the United States always lives up to its commitments, and it will do so here. There, with respect to Ukraine, it's not exactly clear from a military standpoint what those are, but they're very clear when it comes to NATO.
And if one of the NATO countries were to be embroiled in some sort of confrontation with Russia, I know you're a diplomat here, and this isn't perhaps the best question for you, but there's a whole infrastructure of how we managed that military confrontation with the Soviets that would have to be reexamined, reestablished. We can't send the U.S. volunteer army over to confront the Russian army anywhere. I don't care what letter of the law is in the NATO agreement, right?
Actually, no. I think with respect to a NATO member, which is essentially Western Europe and most of Eastern Europe, the Latvian nations are the only piece of the former Soviet territory that are part of NATO. We've had some partnerships with NATO and Georgia. Some people think that that's what's triggered this conflict in both places. I don't believe that. I think these would have happened regardless. I think our NATO relationship with them probably gave them pause. But if any country is attacked by Russia, if there's any territorial infringement, there is no diplomacy needed here to state the facts that we will defend that country with force if necessary. That's a pretty clear-cut NATO commitment. It was originally established after World War II to defend Western Europe against the Soviet Union, and it remains today to defend all NATO countries, there are 28 of them, from any incursion from the Soviet Union. The difference is that Ukraine is not a full NATO member, nor is Georgia. What the NATO countries have done, and very much led by the United States, is to reinforce Article 5, again, which says an attack on one is an attack on all. And that's why I think you will not see Russia go beyond the Ukraine into NATO.
And, Ukraine, in some sense, is already, I mean, you're not going to say this, but on some level, Ukraine is already kind of in the Russian column at this point with the instability that's going on there. So let's put that aside for the moment. But to really defend Poland, don't you have to reengage the whole question of nuclear deterrence and all of that stuff that compensated for the fact that Russia has overwhelming numbers near its borders?
Well, I can't quite let the Ukraine note pass. I think Crimea is gone. I think the future of eastern Ukraine and the rest of Ukraine is very much up for debate. Right now, I don't see either Poland or the Latvian countries being threatened. But if you do, there is no doubt in my mind that you'll see troop movement, overfly exercises, the whole range of NATO exercises and partnerships play out. And of course, a lot of diplomacy. What Putin is trying to do here is very clear. He's been broadcasting this for some time. We saw the playbook in Georgia where he lopped off Abkhazia, claimed it was a separatist state, put Russian troops there, and then did the same thing in Ossetia in Georgia, which essentially lopped off the two portions of Georgia. And to this day, that remains a problem. And then he broadcast very clearly, only 2 weeks after the Olympics, of all things, this guy's got chutzpah, that he was going to take Crimea. And now he's saying the same thing about eastern Ukraine. The playbook is he goes in, riles up the nationalists. It's kind of like what Slobodan Milosevic tried to do in Kosovo. Unfortunately, Europe's sanctions are lagging behind where we'd like to see them. And I think it's up to Europe to step up to the plate now. That's easy for an American to say we're not dependent on Russian oil, but this crisis is going to go on for some time. We're looking at trying to distance the European dependence on Russian oil. We could perhaps become their exporters. They're trying to reverse the pipelines out of Russia that have supplied various countries in Europe to ship oil to Ukraine, in which case they would be much more independent, and to try and sanction Putin's inner circle to make it painful where they can't travel, they can't use their banks. And eventually, I think you'll see oil sanctions. If eastern Ukraine goes, you'll see oil sanctions. So it's going to be a very rough road ahead.
Well, the bigger idea here, though, and it's one raised by The Economist magazine and elsewhere, is that, you know, whatever Putin's playbook means for him, it has certainly emboldened people all over the world to test, okay, what are the U.S. commitments here? What are the real ones, and what ones can't they actually deliver on?
We take our commitments very seriously, and I frankly don't see anywhere across the globe that people are questioning that. They know the United States stands by its commitments and will do so. We don't have military commitments with Ukraine. I find it very odd that some of the president's opponents want him to go around with bare chest and he'll be tough if he invades Mexico or something. I mean, it's quite last century, if not, you know, 18th century. This is, Putin keeps referring to Catherine the Great's reference to the new Russia. This is not the 21st century way. And I think you have to step back and say, what's really going on here? President Putin is deploying tactics that are ruthless, brutal, and ultimately will hurt not only the people of Ukraine, but Russia. Capital flight is fleeing. You'll see defections in his inner circle. The economy is going to be tanking. And he's been able to ride an oil boom, a commodities boom that has made himself and his cohorts extremely wealthy. But the country's going to begin to tank. They've got a low birth rate. They're stopping immigration. People are leaving Russia. And that's ultimately going to be President Putin's legacy if he doesn't reverse course.
Similar arguments were made about the consequences for the nation of Iraq post the invasion of Iraq and the situation in Afghanistan, which you've already mentioned. Do you think America has the stomach politically for these kinds of commitments? Somewhere, is there a kind of squishiness post Iraq and Afghanistan that whatever the president wants to do, the American people might not follow?
There absolutely is we're sick of these wars, get us home. The polls all show that we don't want America to be any more engaged in the world. And that's natural when you've had two wars, thousands of Americans killed, tens of thousands wounded, and trillions of dollars spent. And the question is, what did we get for it? Iraq's still very fragile. Afghanistan could slip back into the Taliban. And that's understandable. But no one is talking about invading with U.S. troops Ukraine. What we're looking for is U.S. leadership, not just in these crises, but in the challenges of the world. I call it the Jell-O factor. If the United States doesn't act, the world's response is Jell-O. You need strong U.S. leadership to set the tone and get others to follow us. And that's exactly what we're doing in Ukraine. We can only do so much. You can give people a path forward, and if they choose not to take it, that is not the fault of the United States. Our commitments are firm to Japan, to South Korea, to Europe. We stand by those commitments, so I don't quite see where people are worried that we're not fulfilling our commitments. I don't know of one that we haven't fulfilled fully. The question is, are we fatigued? Do we want to go into another Iraq or Afghanistan? Absolutely no. And this president has made it very clear that we are not going to be doing that, but we will lead in addressing these conflicts. We're leading on the trying to create prosperity around the globe with these trade agreements, trying desperately to get some address on issues like the food crisis, the water crisis, the environmental crisis, the big issues that are not on the front page. When the United States takes a stance, we try to sort of set the stage for solving these problems. Unfortunately, our politics at home are a little bit broken, so that's difficult to do. But I'm actually quite confident that America will stand by its commitments. And this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's an American thing.
Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, thanks for the candid conversation.
My pleasure.
So forget nation states for a moment with flags and armies and treaties. How about a community like this? A collection of women in their 20s and 30s. We have a veteran, dentists, business owners, decorators, realtors, activists, marketers, assistants, housewives. We span the religious and political spectrums and focus on books with female authors or leads.
All my life I had to fight.
Check out this little community. We are older lesbians who garden, cook, and read together. We are also advocates for the homeless, LGBT teens, and various other issues of life in Florida. And we got this, an all-male club that tends to read books involving various aspects of manhood.
This is a man's world.
Where have the men gone? Where are the men?
This is a man's world.
I am all that is man.
These are just a few of the descriptions of book clubs from around the nation responding to our book club nominations from last week. Nominate your book club to be a part of the Takeaways Master Global Ultimate Book Club on air online, a nation of readers and talkers and thinkers and friends not afraid of big ideas. Now, that sounds like a great idea. Those nominations you just heard came from Christina Davis in Austin, Texas, Jackie Gabrielle in Florida. Her club even has a name, Dykes on Disc. And Max Wall in Portland, Oregon. We'll pick the books to get things rolling this summer. Just keep those nominations rolling in. For instance, I want to join Kristen from Seattle, whose club knows no international border. Our group was formed when our great friend Sue was diagnosed with a terminal disease. We're all old friends, but now dispersed between England and the USA. We get together by Skype. I love having the international selection of books. The rest live in various places in England. I'm the lone American from Seattle. Sadly, our friend Sue passed away in September. Her husband is now a member, and we are now Sybil, S-I-B-L, Sue's International Book Lovers, in her memory. Well, that's a great story. We're very interested in your book club. If you would like to join ours or nominate yours to be a part of this global book club that we're assembling here at The Takeaway, find out more at thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A future taking place in the present suggests that someday the idea of nations fighting wars will be an outmoded way to address international problems. Yeah, it's been said before. The inefficiencies of borders and nation states in a world of global communications and interconnected digital space present new possibilities, though, that are not completely utopian fantasy. It's possible that fixing the famous Heartbleed bug in the so-called OpenSSL security software, something your computers are probably using right now, have you changed your password yet? Confronting the Heartbleed bug may, in fact, be the future of international cooperation. The stakes couldn't be higher. A software glitch at the retailer Target that compromised 40 million credit card numbers is the reason that company's CEO resigned today. But OpenSSL, unlike internal corporate software, is a system maintained by volunteer open-source coders working in a community outside of any corporation or any nation. Heartbleed shows that that system needs some help. Jim Zemlin, executive director of the Linux Foundation, has come up with a way to fund these volunteer open-source problem solvers. Linux itself is a community of coders sharing software that supports the vast Linux universe of digital territory. The Linux Foundation has launched a multi-million-dollar fund to help finance maintenance of core internet functions, including OpenSSL. Donors to the Core Infrastructure Initiative include Google, Microsoft, and Facebook. Jim Zemlin says this is a combination of basic old-fashioned maintenance and some very newfangled notions of governance in the 21st century.
One of the things that's important to understand about the project that we're working on at the Linux Foundation is that it's not limited to OpenSSL. The important thing that we wanted to do is to step back and to look more holistically at projects that are important to the internet and important to society that, like OpenSSL, have been underfunded, and then go and apply some resources and some help to those projects in order to prevent the next Heartbleed.
Typically in society, the way communities deal with infrastructure maintenance is to, you know, enact a tax. But in this particular case, in the software world, you rarely call the government in as the cavalry in a situation like this. I'm curious, though, that the corporate world has been drawn in as the cavalry here, donors to your core foundation.
Correct. These organizations who are looking to help a wide variety of open source projects that are important to the stability of the internet are not just doing it as a charitable act. It's in the business interest of all of these organizations to have a stable and secure internet. So what we're doing here is essentially creating a very simple leveraged investment that people can in turn share in providing resources to these important open source projects without losing the important organic and, you know, self-forming communities that make open source such an important and dynamic part of the internet itself.
Isn't the fair way to do this, though, to enact a kind of fee-for-service operation that if you use the internet infrastructure, if you're an Amazon or an online retailer or the NSA, for that matter, that you have to pay to make sure that you can be confident that it is secure?
I think that would be a simple solution, but it wouldn't be the right solution. You know, the whole idea of free and open source software is that it is available for anyone to use for anything they would like, and that people can then in turn improve that code and share those improvements. Implementing some form of tax probably would undermine the great work that the open source community does.
What do you have as an outcome here? What would you hope to be the result 5 years down the road here? The response to Heartbleed has been less than people might have expected, given the severity of the security problem, partly because the fix is complicated on the consumer level and on the software development level. Do you want people to change to anticipate problems like Heartbleed? Do you want more participants 5 years from now? What are the metrics?
First of all, I think that the response to Heartbleed has been actually quite rapid and quite robust. We will continue to have security vulnerabilities across a wide variety of internet infrastructure. That's sort of a fact of life. But what's important here, and what I think would be a terrific outcome, is rather than acting on these vulnerabilities in a reactive manner, we would instead get ahead of them and look for the next Heartbleed in advance by trying to identify these market failures. I also think that one of the outcomes here is a forum within which the industry and experts in security and open source can get together and actually have this discussion.
I'm wondering, and you're big on the big idea here as executive director of the Linux Foundation, if this is not so much about encryption and computer security, but what we're seeing is the development of a 21st century model for democracy and community and engagement that knows no national border, knows no particular corporate identity, and really is the future of how people are going to interact in communities to solve problems.
That is exactly correct. So what you're really seeing here is people understand we are now living in a shared economy. People now understand that it's in their business interest to share in the development of important infrastructure. And in doing so, they can pursue their business interests as well. And I think that's an important concept. And hopefully this small effort will be a part of that.
but you're going to have to get more than a third of the people affected by Heartbleed to change their passwords to, you know, recognize this as a democratic success, right?
Well, we certainly encourage everyone to change their passwords in this case.
The equivalent of voting in the 21st century. Change your password, right?
Perhaps.
Jim Zemlin is the executive director of the Linux Foundation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So world peace with cooperative software designers running things is surely a few months or years away. Later this hour, watching democracy grapple with two visions of a nation on the streets of Odessa, Ukraine.
We're inevitably caught up in the events that are occurring daily in the city. But at least for my part, and my kids are here as it happens also, we try not to get entangled in the worst of it.
Later this hour, Nikolai Petro, University of Rhode Island political science professor in Odessa with his family on a Fulbright scholarship that has become something of an unexpected adventure. But first, a crumbling brick and mortar infrastructure that needs hardware, not software repairs, roads and bridges, and the fund that's about to run out of money for repairing them. That's next on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A slightly more down-to-earth maintenance crisis now, $302 billion worth, according to the Obama administration. The U.S. Highway Trust Fund needs about that much to give states money to pay to fix crumbling roads and bridges. Congress needs to pass an authorization or there will be no new projects this year. The director of Rhode Island's Department of Transportation, Michael Lewis, joins me now. Michael, welcome.
John, pleasure to be with you today.
Pleasure. Maybe it'd be better to be talking under other circumstances. What are you worried about here in this pipeline that seems to be drying up?
Well, for many years now, the states have relied on the Highway Trust Fund, which is every one of us around the country as we fill up our tanks with gas, whether we're in Honolulu or Arkansas or Providence, Rhode Island, you're paying 18.4 cents of a gas tax. And that's what has been distributed to all the states to ensure we have a sound, robust federal transportation system across this country. And that is in danger of drying up this summer. And unless Congress acts, come 2015, which fiscal year 2015, which begins October 1st, the states could be getting zero in federal money to go towards our highway and transit infrastructure.
Now, is this one of these continuing resolution things where a divided Congress is holding something hostage, or has the math changed in the complexity of the repair programs and either the tax has to increase or Congress has to authorize a fundamentally different budget to this problem?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both and something else. The gas tax hasn't been increased since 1993. And if we all look back to what we were doing 20 years ago, what was our income level? If we none of us have gotten a cost of living increase since 1993, I think we could all understand that we wouldn't be able to buy as much as we did back then. So that's a situation. We're taking in less from the gas tax in real terms than we did 20 years ago. And our needs have become that much more. We have an aging infrastructure across this country. All of us that are of a certain age have lived with an interstate highway system, and we don't remember what life was like, or we didn't know what life was like without it. We take it for granted. But that system, 46,000 miles across the country, along with all the other national highway system, is aging. It's reaching a 56 to 60 year design life, and much of it needs to be rebuilt and rehabilitated. And we simply don't have the revenues in order to take on that very large task.
What's the glaring symbol in your state of a repair that needs to happen? I guess it's not a symbol if it's crumbling before before your very eyes.
It's very real. We look outside the window and we drive on it every day. We have Interstate 95 runs right through the heart of the state. We have what we call the Providence Viaduct. It was built in the mid-60s when the interstate was cut through Rhode Island, and it's reached the end of its service life. It's a couple hundred million dollar replacement, and we simply don't have the revenues to take care of it unless we stop investing in all the other road and bridge needs across the state. And that we're a small state, Rhode Island, but like many smaller population states, we are very dependent upon the federal program. And without a robust program, we are at risk across this country of becoming a island of haves in a sea of have-nots. We're dependent upon a strong federal system. It matters a great deal to the orange growers in Florida that the highways in Wyoming and Montana are in good shape so they can get their produce to Seattle and Portland. It matters a lot to the lobster fishermen in Maine that the highways on I-95 in Rhode Island are in good shape so they can get their product to New York and Washington, D.C.
And it matters a lot to Americans all over the country that our infrastructure not end up looking like the Acropolis in Athens. Nice tourist attraction, but doesn't function. Michael Lewis, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be with you, John.
He's the director of Rhode Island's Department of Transportation, waiting for some federal money. This week, the NFL Draft will answer the question, what team will Johnny Football play for, or what team will Jadeveon Clowney play for, and which one will Houston Texans be picking? They'll bet their franchise on one of these players. It reminds us of the 1998 draft, and that's where the Retro Report team takes us back to. The Colts picked Peyton Manning. Ryan Leaf went to the San Diego Chargers. Jonathan Gruber, a director with Retro Report, joins me now. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, the draft every year, in some sense, tries to predict the performance of college athletes based on all kinds of intangibles. Is it a fool's game, do you think?
Well, you know, just to step back, if you think of it like a more traditional job, you want to hire the right person. And the difference is there's millions of dollars at stake and reputations. So it's worth it for teams and the league to at least try new methods for testing these intangibles, things that have been really hard to quantify, whether motivation, resiliency, grace under pressure. Some people feel there's been some success, but if you look at, say, the conference championships last year, three out of the four quarterbacks were not drafted in the first round.
And the draft this year will be under the microscope with more coverage perhaps than ever before. What was unique about the 1998 NFL draft?
What was unique about the 1998 NFL draft was there were these two quarterbacks really so highly touted and coming out together, Ryan Leaf and Peyton Manning. And usually you'll have one quarterback, it's can't miss. But these were two quarterbacks that were can't miss. And people were really on either side, who's better? And they both, the positives and negatives were different for each, where Peyton Manning, his dad, Archie Manning, was a former Pro Bowl quarterback in the NFL, sort of had the lineage, and he was very intellectual about the game. In addition, you know, tremendous skills, really a tremendous game manager. Ryan Leaf was sort of this a little bit more unfinished quarterback, but had tremendous upside. He could throw a ball 80 yards flat-footed, and really people could see tremendous potential in him. And so people were saying, well, do we take the person who's ready to go right now, more pro-ready in Peyton Manning, or do we take someone like Ryan Leaf, who might be a little bit rough, but really down the road could be just unbelievable.
And of course, we know what happened with Peyton Manning. But here's how Lee Steinberg, who was Ryan Leaf's agent, remembered the beginning of that 1998 year.
It all started well for Ryan Leaf. He had a good training camp, and he won his first couple games.
That was a positive beginning. Didn't work out that way, though, terribly well.
Right. And, you know, what happened was that shortly after those first two games, there was a third game against the Kansas City Chiefs. He had a terrible game. And he lost his cool in the locker room and yelled at a reporter. Now, this has probably happened in the past with pro athletes and reporters. Someone happened to be recording it.
Don't talk to me, all right? Knock it off!
He was caught on camera in the locker room yelling at a reporter.
I misdirected my anger after the Kansas City game. I was extremely disappointed in my performance, and I let it show.
I'm wondering here, Jonathan, if the pressure of the NFL in some sense wipes out the objective criteria of athletic performance, the kinds of tests that you can pass in college, but not so much in the NFL.
I would think so. I mean, it's like anyone under pressure in any field. They might have the great test scores and all of the awards and all the extracurricular activities, but throw them in there into the, you know, under the limelight, and it's really hard to define what makes someone achieve and others wilt.
What happened to Ryan Leaf?
Well, Ryan, unfortunately, after a couple of years with the Chargers, he moved to some other teams, and eventually, 4 years after he was drafted, he left football. He retired. I think he was 26. And then he wound up doing some coaching and doing some different things, but unfortunately, he had a prescription pill addiction and wound up being sent to prison for breaking into people's homes in Great Falls, Montana. And he is in prison right now.
Jonathan Gruber, a director with the Retro Report. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, John.
An eyewitness view now of the situation in Ukraine from an observer who never expected to be at the center of an international crisis where borders and national identities are suddenly in flux. Odessa, Ukraine's third largest city in the southwest of the country on the Black Sea, has seen the violence of eastern Ukraine on its streets. Pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian demonstrators clashed in the streets, hurling rocks and Molotov cocktails. 46 people died in the bloodshed on Friday, most as a result of a fire that broke out in a building downtown. Nikolai Petro and his family are in Odessa. He's a University of Rhode Island political science professor on a Fulbright academic scholarship. Nikolai, welcome.
Hello.
What's it like being in the middle of all this on a Fulbright? I mean, you're not a combatant, but you're certainly seeing on the streets everything that we're seeing in the headlines.
I think academics call this being a participant observer. We're inevitably caught up in the events that are occurring daily in the city, but at least for my part, and my kids are here, as it happens, also just visiting, we try not to, you know, get entangled in the worst of it.
What is your Fulbright on? Does it involve cooperation that might bridge this divide between the pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian factions in this community that you're visiting?
It's actually a research Fulbright which is looking at the role of religion in politics. So although that issue hasn't come up a great deal, I'm at least encouraged to see that the religious figures in the country are calling everyone to take a step back and reflect on the dangers of the moment.
With that in mind, how divided is Ukraine right now? And is it on a street-by-street, house-by-house basis, as you've been able to view?
I think there are more than 20 regions, and each of those has a distinct flavor.
How does that play out right in Odessa, where you are?
For the most part, things have been calm here. And there's a regular place where the pro-government groups gather, and they gather weekly, and, you know, kind of rally support for a united Ukraine and let's give the government a chance. And about a mile and a half away from that was where there had been the anti-government demonstrators who are saying, well, what happened in Kyiv was an illegal coup, and we don't want to be subjected to their whims, and so let's have greater local autonomy and federalism. And what's been happening is that those two sides have kept to themselves and had a fairly civil discourse. But on May 2nd, things got out of hand, partly because a group of football fanatics came to town and added their weight into this mix. And then all the groups coalesced in the center and had a fight on their hands. And then from that, part of that group decided to continue that fight and take it to the groups that had gathered in the second location that were against the government. And they razed the tent city that had been there, chased the anti-government groups into the local building and then set that building on fire. And that's how most of the people were killed.
And that's dozens, more than 40.
Yeah, for about roughly 40 people, yeah.
How curious or terrified are your own children about all this? I don't know their ages, but I'm wondering.
They're 22 and 26, so they're adults. I must say they're very interested, obviously, and they were watching YouTube and everything. I discourage them from actually trying to see things firsthand. But we live very close. We rent an apartment very close to the events that took place on May 2nd. And so when we, the next morning, we went there and to observe for ourselves what had been left. And I was frankly, amazed to see that they'd done an excellent cleanup job, because what the street where they were having the altercations is actually a central tourist area, and so they were very quick to clean it up. And I must say, by noon, when we went there again, the usual tourists were there, and you could really not have even known that the day before there had been all these tragic events.
As a political scientist, what ghosts are haunting this conflict from the last century, and ghosts that I suspect are even in your own family?
Well, these events do have a prehistory. In World War II, this fight between those who wanted to use the German invasion of the Soviet Union to rally on behalf of an independent Ukraine, that sort of formed one side of the global conflict, versus those who thought, well, we can't afford this right now because the Nazis are killing all of us. And so there was a division right in the middle of World War II. And those historical memories are lingering and do form a backdrop to the discourse that we have today. And so in the East and the South, people tend to not just be more sympathetic to Russia, but also to remember the history of World War II as a valiant cause in which they fought against the Nazi invaders. Whereas in the West, there tends to be much more sympathy for the cause of the Ukrainian insurgent army, which was allied with Hitler's army.
Where would your parents come down on what's going on right now if they were able to observe and argue about it?
My family would be split probably right down the middle, because my mother's German, my father's Russian, and I've grown up in Europe. And so I guess I look to all sides with a certain amount of sympathy, because I've known people on all sides of this debate.
Well, we're glad your eyes are on this conflict, and we hope to speak with you again.
Thank you very much.
We think of national borders as inviolate, flags as permanent. How many stars on the U.S. flag? How many were there in 1950 or 1920? These permanent-feeling symbols have a way of changing or vanishing sometimes.
This is the middle of the checkpoint. The police are making no attempt to stop people. The gates have been thrown open, and thousands of people are pouring over to take a look at a West. In some cases, their first look, and the elation is enormous.
Nearly 25 years ago, the Berlin Wall, that nearly everyone in the world thought was essentially permanent, came down. The division of Germany, it simply went away.
A year and a half ago, in Germany, I said that our goal was a Europe whole and free. Tonight, Germany is united. Europe has become whole and free.
It was a heroic moment for President George H.W. Bush and his New World Order, a heroic moment for West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who would preside over the newly unified Germany. But it was a disorienting moment for the family of writer Maxim Leo and so many other East Germans who saw their nation simply vanish overnight. The book Red Love, the story of an East German family, written by journalist Maxim Leo, takes you into this moment that the whole world saw as a victory for the West, but Leo saw as his country, the only place he'd ever known, being swept away by history.
It was a historical night, and I spent this night on the other side in West Berlin, And I passed through the checkpoint Charlie, and they decided to get sleep. And it was a big mistake.
And the German Democratic Republic, the GDR, which was a big deal during the entire Cold War. I remember all the Olympic medals, the intensity of the divide between West and East Germany. Poof, is completely gone, but it lives clearly in your heart and in a lot of your longings. What is the psychological dimension of what East Germany was? What would you say it is? It's a state of mind on some level.
First, it's a very particular thing that because, you know, East Germany, the state disappeared. It's the only eastern state which just disappeared. You know, the Polish men have Poland, the Czech men have the Czech Republic, but we have memories. And at the same time, the state is lost, but our memories are still there. And I have trees in my street, and I just wonder if it's an East German tree or a West German tree. And if I'm from East Germany or from West Germany now, that's very complicated questions.
Your grandfather, it wasn't so complicated for him. East Germany was the heroic winner of the war, the anti-Nazi true believers. And he believed that to the end.
Yes, it was very important for him, this conviction, this very strong beliefs, because it made it possible to support all this lies and all these very difficult things that he had to support in the East Germany. And my grandfather always told me they want to build a state safe for all people and especially for Jewish people.
A utopia, a workers' paradise.
A workers' paradise and an alternative system, because he was convinced that capitalism and Nazism was in the same way.
Describe this amazing story that you tell in this book of how your mother became a persona non grata, that she suggested that someone be made a part of the party. And suggestion was so provocative that it resulted in the interrogation of a bunch of her colleagues. And they, in a room that you know well, had to declare themselves, I've done badly. I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. And it scarred their relationship for the rest of their lives. What happened there?
It was a kind of brainwashing. And this technique of auto-criticism came from the Russia, and from Stalin. And the logic was to integrate people in the system. If they start to lie, they will continue to lie, and they will convince other people to lie. And when my mother was growing up, there was a real risk to go in prison, to be ejected from the university if you just made one wrong decision.
When you're in a state like East Germany and there are so many lies around you, is there also a sense of belonging, or is it purely oppression?
No, I think most of the people, 80% of life is normal, it's as normal as in the Western country. You fell in love, you are angry, you are lucky. You just have problems if you start to have a political opinion and your own opinion. And in this case, you have problems in the dictatorship. But for many people, dictatorship is comfortable because you don't have to take decisions. You don't have any responsibility.
Do you think East Germany, in some sense, put a scar in your parents' hearts, changed them in some way that you would love to be able to change? It certainly broke your grandfather's heart.
The end of East Germany. Yeah. When the war came down, all his projects, all
his reality,
believings and reality,
his symbols, everything,
fell down. It was the end of a dream. For my mother, she was literally speechless. After the wall came down, she went the first time to the West, and she wasn't able to speak. And she was convinced that life in West Germany would be impossible for her. And after she realized that it was possible and the GDR wasn't so important for her.
Were you proud of the GDR as you grew up, their Olympic successes? Did you root for
the GDR?
No, I never was so proud about it because first the GDR was not cool, you know. The West Germany was cool, yeah. And GDR, it was difficult to be proud of them. When the GDR disappeared, I, for the first time, felt attached by this country because it was so quickly gone.
Given all of that, what are your thoughts looking at the crisis in eastern Ukraine and this new real confidence on the part of Vladimir Putin and the Russians last week marching in Red Square on May Day in numbers we haven't seen since the Cold War?
Yeah, it's very bizarre to realize that there is an attachment to the Russian state from the German population, but not just from the East German population, also from the West German population. Even myself, I can feel it. My impression is that the Western countries didn't support enough Russia in the last years, and that this reaction from Putin is a reaction of our behavior and that we pushed in some way Putin in this direction. But what's going on in this region at the moment is showing me how lucky we was that there was stability and there was a state, an East and West German state, who just helped us to got a new system and to got a stability, because they never had that. And I don't know if Ukraine will still exist in 10 years.
Hmm. Maxim Leo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Maxim Leo is the author of a new book, Red Love, The Story of an East German Family. One last thing. The Takeaway family wants you to be a part of our book club project. Just go to thetakeaway.org to find out how you and your book club can join up or shout out at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.